welcome to Endeavors, broadcasting to you from wherever you are, wherever you may be going, or wherever you may have been. We have a fantastic show lined up for you today. We actually have four guests. You heard me talk at the top of the show about the Middle East, and there's a great film out of Jordan called Thebe. It's actually only the second film Jordan has ever submitted to be considered for Best Foreign Language Film at the Academy Awards. It's made up of a cast of non-professional actors, mainly composed of Bedouins. And its director, Naji Nawaz, spoke with me last week about his project. You'll also hear from former editor-in-chief of the Globe and Mail, John Stackhouse, about the digital media revolution that has been 30 years in the making. The newspaper industry was in decline long before the internet came around. And he's got a new book about it too, Mass Disruption. So we'll talk to him about that. I also have two great Canadian bands on today. One is called The Motor League, and they're out of Moncton. And the other band is called The Dying Arts, and they're out of Toronto. So it's a fun-packed show for you today. And we're going to start with a song by Motor League off their new album, Holding Patterns. This is And You Won't Believe What Happens Next.
Don't
That was the Motor League from Moncton, New Brunswick, with And You Won't Believe What Happens Next. But happening next is my interview with Najee Abu Nawar, who is the director of the great new Jordanian film and their official Oscar submission for Best Foreign Language Film, Thieb. It played at TIFF 2014 and won Best Director at the Venice Film Festival. It is a Bedouin-style western that takes place in a remote part of the Ottoman Empire in 1916, where a young boy and his brother escort a British officer across desert. It marks the debut of Oxford-born director Najee Abu Nawar, and I had a chance to speak with him a little while back. I'm here with Najee Abu Nawar, the director of Thieb. Hello, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
This is a very interesting film, and if I'm correct, it's only the second film produced in Jordan within the last, you know, 50 plus years. How did this project start for you?
This film is it's the second sort of totally independent film in the last sort of decade to 20 years. There have been other films, but they've been government-sponsored films. So this is like one of the first independent ones. The project really began because I had seen how Kurosawa had adapted the samurai culture and sort of used the Westerns sort of in the spirit of John Ford, and how he'd done that with films like Yojimbo and Sanjiro and Seven Samurai. And I loved the way he did that. And I had grown up, as most people in the Middle East grow up, with the folklore and sort of fairy tales of the Bedouin knights. It's kind of like the knights culture that you might find in England. Sort of tales of great chivalry and heroism. And that's sort of what, you know, grandfathers and parents, you know, tell their children, you know, bedtime stories and that kind of thing. And my father, sort of the wonderful storyteller, he used to tell me these types of stories all the time. So I thought the two would work really well if you took that kind of concept, samurai movie or the Western, and you applied it to Bedouin culture. I thought that would be really cool. And then really, I tried to write a screenplay. It was the first thing. I was just starting out. It's the first thing I tried to write. Really bad, really terrible and cliche. And I kind of gave up before I even finished it. And then fast forward to like 10 years later, and Basil Vandoor, who is a Jordanian screenwriter, just graduated from USC film school. He came with his first short, and it was sort of the short film script was like a story of Bedouin brothers on a hunting trip that goes wrong. It was kind of exactly what I'd been dreaming about doing, and Basil actually done it. So I asked Basil if we could work together on making this a feature film, and thankfully said yes. And really what Basil and I then did was realize that you've got to do this right, you've got to go down and research the Bedouin, you've got to live with the Bedouin so we can tell the story as accurately as we can. And really that's where the film comes from. It comes from the time we spent learning Bedouin culture and living with the Bedouin, hearing their stories and their poems. That's where you see the film on the big screen.
How would you describe the filmmaking culture in that part of the world? I mean, it's not necessarily a country one would think off the top of their head for art.
No, you know, there's not much of a film industry. We get a lot of foreign films coming in to shoot, but we don't have a lot of homegrown films made. We also like things like exhibition and distribution, you know, not just in Jordan, but across the Arab world, is very difficult. The only real, you know, cinema industry with mass distribution and that kind of thing is the Egyptian industry. And they guard their industry very, very sort of, you know, securely. And so it's very difficult for an Arabic film outside of Egypt to gain distribution in Egypt. So it's a tough thing to make independent film in the Middle East, or any kind of film in the Middle East, because there is very much of an industry. Usually what you find are sort of, let's say, political people who are using film as the medium for which to get across their message. And I kind of feel that that's the vast majority of the cinema that I've been watching and seeing over the last 10 years. And that's the kind of films that get funded by the European funding bodies and international funding bodies, who also have a sort of political agenda or want to show a light on you know, what's going on in the Middle East today. Not that there's anything wrong with that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But that's not the kind of cinema that I want to make. You know, I love cinema. I'm doing this because I am devoted to filmmaking. Is, you know, the thing I love the most in life. That's all I want to do. It's all I've ever wanted to do. And so that's why I'm doing it. So I'm trying to do a different kind of thing. And hopefully, you know, we'll continue to get the chance to do that. And, you know, the film has been received very well. So I'm hoping it will now open up the door for me to be able to make more.
The decision to use non-actors or non-professional actors in all the roles, did that just come out of necessity, or was that a conscious decision to make?
That came out of necessity and rationality, basically. You know, we don't have a film industry. We don't have a wide pool of actors to cast from. So that means that there are very, very few professional actors, and most of them work in what we call the Musalsalat, which are like the telenovelas, you know, the kind of soap operas. And obviously the acting in that is very, very different from the kind of film acting, you know, traditions. So I don't like casting from those worlds because I don't like the way the actors perform. And it's very difficult, therefore, to break down someone who's a veteran or experienced in those telenovela-style soap opera performances, break them down to give a film performance. They're also, you know, it's also the mainstream form of entertainment, so it's very difficult to convince people to do that as well. The necessity is to, you know, if you're making a film in the desert, or even in Amman, your necessity basically is to sort of use non-actors. But it also makes a lot of sense for this film because we're shooting a film about the Bedouin, you know, for authenticity's sake as well, it's good to have, you know, real Bedouin in the roles because obviously that helps you with authenticity. So it kind of worked out on this one. But generally speaking, you know, most of the roles you have to fill have to be filled by non-actors, and that's not a choice. I would love to work with top-notch professional actors. That would be fantastic. But that's just the situation we're in, and we have to do the best we can with what we have.
When I was watching it struck me to be similar to a film that I love called Turtles Can Fly, out of Iran. And I'm wondering if you find that just in that part of the world, you know, Jordan, the Middle East, and, you know, even moving further to Iraq and Iran, whether there's a sort of specific style of filmmaking or a specific approach to filmmaking that makes the quality of films that much better.
I'm not sure. I think I haven't seen the film you referred to, but I think because specifically also the Bedouin culture, which spans across all the regions and countries you're talking about, the oral storytelling traditions are so continuous, so long established over, you know, thousands of years, you know, that there's an excellent rhythm and an excellent style of storytelling and an oral storytelling that I think very much lends itself to cinema and makes for interesting and exciting cinema. And I think that's part of the culture. And I think a lot of people, I mean, I'm guessing, but I'm gonna guess that a lot of people would say that probably the oral storytelling would be one of their biggest influences or an element of their influences. These kind of folkloric tales that fathers tell children, they're highly visual, highly dramatic, and in a way they lend themselves to cinema very much because they inspire imagery in the listener's ear, and it's like you're watching a film. You know, my father, when he used to tell me stories, I used to experience them as, you know, films. You know, he put me in the room and I was seeing the characters and I was hearing the world, and it was a very visceral experience. And I think that's probably what helps filmmakers as they grow up in that tradition.
So, I mean, I think there's, when I was watching the film, I noticed, you know, the pacing of it was very good and very much like your typical independent film, I guess. What do you like about independent film as to sort of, you know, the more maybe telenovelas you mentioned or the more studio pictures?
It's difficult for me. You know, I've never been part of the industry. So I was having an interesting conversation with another journalist about this a few days ago. A lot of these terms, I don't really understand what they mean because I've not worked in the industry. I've basically sort of been writing my own scripts, developing them. You know, they've fallen through. They've got to various stages of finance. They've fallen through, making a short. And I've gone to a few festivals with that. So really, I knew nothing about the world of cinema, the world of festivals, the world of film criticism, other than just loving film and watching film. So I always kind of, whenever people say sort of, like here a lot of people have been referring to it as art house or independent, or and I know that I just referred to it as independent, but I meant independent more in the sense it's not a governmental film, it's, right. It's just a film by sort of normal civilians. So I find it difficult. The categorizing of these things, I'm not familiar with that much.
Right.
You know, the decisions I made about the pacing of the film all came from the experience of living life with the Bedouin. There's a certain rhythm that they live their life in, which is sort of very calm and patient, and then interspersed with very sort of, if something goes down, very brief and violent and active moments, then returning to it calm and patient again. And that's just the sort of the rhythm of life as you experience it there. The visualization of the film is based on the experience of being in a vast terrain that is so epic in sort of visual nature and so sort of overwhelming, but at the same time, you can hear a beetle on the ground scuttling across your feet. Like at the same time, it's so intimate, such a microcosm world where every sound is amplified, and you know, your experience of your relations between people, talking to someone, is so much more sort of powerful because you're one on one with someone, and then there's just nothing, and there's just this vast expanse.
Yeah.
So that's where the kind of decisions for the film were made.
I'm curious as to, you know, given that part of the world and a lot of the, I guess, the political and the religious situations that are going on, I'm wondering how much of that can affect the filmmaking process, either at a creative level or just at a sort of level of actually trying to get it into production.
I think, you know, there are certain, you know, so on a practical level, for instance, a good example of this, due to sort of increasing conservatism as a result of the Bedouin being settled from the north into villages, the spread of more conservative religious doctrine has occurred, or a movement towards sort of alcoholism and drug abuse. It's kind of split communities in half. And that meant we weren't allowed to film women for the film. We weren't allowed to workshop them. I wasn't allowed to actually talk to them during my stay there. So that can be a real problem, obviously. There was very important key roles in the film that were roles for women, in particular Veeb's mother, Hussein's fiance, and some such things. And we weren't able to get the women in the film, which meant that, you know, those roles had to be cut, which is very sad. The good news is that because we've shown that, you know, filmmaking is now a respectful process, the tribes have agreed to allow women to be workshopped, and you know, so hopefully the next one will have women. Just a little example of, like, you know, the challenges that you face in the Middle East. Obviously, you know, we're very lucky in Jordan. Jordan is a safe country, and you know, we you know, there are laws. laws in place in Jordan, which mean you can film whatever you want in Jordan. There's no censorship on shooting. There are censors for what you exhibit in cinemas, but not for what you shoot. So there's that kind of freedom. And obviously, you know, everywhere else around us, there's war and conflict. So obviously, it's a very difficult situation. But Jordan's fine, you know, for that. It's really about making social changes and working to prove to people that what you're doing is respectable and is artistic and is worth something, has merit.
You mentioned that this is your first film and you're sort of outside the industry. Do you think you want to continue along the independent path, or can you foresee a time when you would make a big blockbuster type film?
I would absolutely love to make a big blockbuster type film, but for me, I see it as I'm very sort of strategic in the sense that I'm not going to jump into anything I can't handle. You know, I'm still learning, I'm still improving. Obviously, coming from Jordan without the experience of the film industry, there's a lot of technical information in filmmaking that I don't know. I mean, you know, a first-time filmmaker also is inexperienced anyway. And then add to that, I haven't been exposed to a lot of technical information and things like that. There's a huge learning curve I had to undertake. So I'm not in any hurry to try and, you know, overjump my capabilities. Obviously, I devote my life to improving and grasping and learning so that I can grow as a filmmaker. But I'm also not arrogant to think that I'm ready to do something huge now. I still have a lot of information, skill, and experience to gain. So in the future, I would look to do that if it was under the right conditions and it was something that I could make my own and do, have my own voice in something like that. Obviously, I have big ambitions for the films I want to do in Jordan. I want to grow as a filmmaker in Jordan and make bigger films in Jordan. The word big is a difficult thing, but in essence, you know, I love that type of filmmaking. I love the Kurosawa films. You know, I love David Lean. I love John Ford. I love those types of Stanley Kubrick. I just love all those types of filmmakers.
Yeah.
So, or even highly sort of like the Kieslowski films. They're grand. They're powerful. Thinking of like The Double Life of Veronique, or you know, you're experiencing cinema. Blue, which is my favorite part of the three colors, actually. Yeah. That's really cinema. So I want to progress onto that. I want to grow with that.
Now, I know you were born in Oxford, and the film industry, and you know, and just the style of films coming out of Britain is quite remarkable. I'm curious as to whether that had any influence on your career.
For me, the big influence. So I moved back between England and Jordan my whole life. There are sort of two really big influences in England. One was that when I was a child, my mother used to go, twice a week, she'd go get the grocery shopping or something, or do stuff in the town, in the centre of Oxford, and she'd take me to the cinema. That's sort of where I developed my love of film, of cinema. And then obviously the second one is when I discovered the National Film Theatre in London, which is now called the BFI. Back then it was called the National Film Theatre. And when I was in my early teens, I was about 13 or so, I had a friend who lived in London. And on the weekends, I would catch the bus up and we'd go to the National Film Theatre. And that's where I discovered filmmakers like Kurosawa or David Lynch, which was crazy to experience for the first time. The first David Lynch I saw was screening of Blue Velvet in the National Film Theatre when I was like 15. I snuck in. Those are very powerful experiences, and that really influenced me. I couldn't actually get a job in film in England. I tried for about, I lived there for about 2 years in London after I graduated from university. tried to get, you know, internship, free work, volunteer work on films, but I couldn't pay to get a job. And I was, you know, I just spent most of the time waitering and doing I used to construct like catwalks and like music stages and stuff for concerts and fashion shows and things like that. I'd go and install them. I couldn't get a job. So I write in my free time. So again, that's what I meant. I'm not like part of the industry. I didn't know what's going on with the industry.
Right. Given this is your first film, you've already won a couple of major awards, mainly the best director at the Venice Film Festival. What has that been like to experience for you all? You know, it's your first film and you're getting all these major awards.
It's been a wonderful experience. Venice was really special because we brought the Bedouin with us, and I got them their first passports. And they got on their first plane and arrived in Venice, first time leaving the country, first time on a speedboat. You know, they were very shocked to see that Venice was sort of all made out of water, which is the exact opposite to their lifestyle in the desert. And it was the first time they walked into a cinema to watch the premiere of their film in front of 1,500 audience members, who then gave them a 10-minute standing ovation. So it was just an unbelievable, highly emotional, euphoric moment that I'm certain I will never have that experience again as a filmmaker. You know, I hope I get the chance to grow as a filmmaker and make better films, but I don't think I'll have such a powerful experience of premiering a film with an audience and with those guys and being your first film and all that. All these elements of first time experiences that contributed to that moment were, you know, it was a crazy mix. It was a really special moment, you know, to win these awards and to go on and to, you know, have, you know, people come up and say, you know, strangers come up and say, oh, I really loved your film and stuff. I mean, it just doesn't get any better. You can't get any higher. Yeah. It's really just amazing high, amazing experience. And I've been, you know, enjoyed every second of it. Got to travel around the world, and, you know, never really been able to travel during my life, and this enabled me to like travel around. You know, I've been to like over 25 countries around the world. I'm happy. It's pretty much as happy as you can get right now. I don't think you can get much happier.
Well, the film is Thieb, Naji Abu Nawar. It's a great film. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Cheers.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
That was Naji Abu Nawar, the director of Thieb, which is out now. We're going to play another song here for you from the Motor League. This is It Only Hurts When I Breathe.
Don't delay.
That was "It Only Hurts When I Breathe" by the Motor League, the Moncton, New Brunswick-based hard rock band with punk undertones. The Motor League was formed out of the ashes of outfits the Ditch Pigs and the Monoxides, until it became a full-fledged thing. Their EP, Black Noise, was released in 2009, with their follow-up, Acknowledge, released in 2013. Lead singer Don Levandier says, "I never knew whether I wanted to be in a punk band or a Fu Manchu ripoff." Their new album is Holding Patterns, and I got to speak with lead singer Don Levandier last week.
Hey, we can talk about real stuff if you want.
I am here with Don Levandier from the Motor League. Hello.
Hey, man.
How you doing?
Good. Excellent. 10 out of 10.
You cut the tail end of your sound check.
Mm.
You guys have a new album, Holding Pattern.
Yeah.
Where did this album start for you?
Wow. Well, I mean, you know, our last record took a long time to make. It was like a 3-year recording process. And this one, we were like, no, man, we can't do that again. It's impossible. So we just kind of like bunked down last winter, like last December, I guess almost a year ago now. And we just bunked down in Moncton in like the heat of the snow, all the worst, you know, 6 feet of snow and all that stuff. And just started writing hard. So we wrote like 32 songs for this record. And then obviously narrowed it down to 11 that got released. So I think it started out of just like ambition to put songs together quickly and to just get back in the studio and like burn a record out like as fast as we could, and still, you know, still making it good and not, you know, cutting any corners and have it be crappy.
You guys are from Moncton, which by Vancouver standards is a small town, and you guys are sort of, you know, hard rock and hard-nosed punks. When you guys sort of, you know, first started, and even with your earlier stuff like Ditch Pigs, do you think it was initially tough to find an audience in a town like that, or was it, you know, right away you guys had a fan base?
Well, you're definitely right that it's a small town. I mean, by Vancouver standards, by any standards, really, it's like maybe 150,000 people, I'm going to say. So in a town like that, you know, we did at the time have a very close-knit music community. So it wasn't really too tough in the beginning to find like a home back then. It's tougher now. You know, I think you get like new technologies like Facebook and stuff, and they're all really good, in Twitter, but they don't necessarily really do a lot to bring a music community together, like a small town. Like Facebook's not really doing anything for the local shows back home. So I think it would be harder now than it was in like, say, 2005 or 2006. When everyone was on like message boards. That was a big thing back then. And those were really great. Message boards were really great for like kind of building and fostering a music scene in a small town. But those kind of dried up, so...
Well, there's still Reddit, but...
There's still Reddit, yeah. I don't know if there's a subreddit for, like, Moncton music scene or not. Maybe there should be. Maybe I should start that. Yeah.
Now, I read that this band kind of was fostered from the remains of a couple other bands, one being Ditch Pigs that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And I think I read on your bio somewhere that you weren't sure if you wanted to be in a punk band or sort of Fu Manchu's reincarnate.
Yeah, 100%. Like, and I still don't, you know, like, our band is named after a Propaganda song, obviously, so, like, that's, you know, there's a lot of punk rock influence, and for me, like, you know, ranging to anything back from the, you know, the Dead Kennedys first couple records, so, like, you know, I love Bad Religion and NOFX and all the Fat Record stuff and all the early Epitaph stuff was all, like, a huge influence, but then at the same time, I was really obsessed with, like, desert punk and, you know, like, Caius and Fu Manchu, anything Brant Bjork touched, to a lesser extent, Queens of the Stone Age, all that stuff. Like, I was, you know, super obsessed with that. So I always kind of ended up being in bands that were, like, a merging of the two. Like, a faster version, like, all those one-string stoner riffs, but just, like, these kind of way faster drums. And I think that what that ended up doing is it always seems to piss people who are, like, the defenders of punk rock and, you know, the record store guys, like, it always seems to piss them off, like, they're not a punk band, but then you still end up, you know, in this thing where you're too punky to be on the radio. So
I love that you mentioned that, because I've had this debate with a lot of people about, you know, what classifies as punk, you know, what qualifies as punk, like, you know, people are like Green Day sold out and they're no longer punk, you know, or like, you know, the Ramones, even though they invented punk, they wouldn't be punk by today's standards, right? Is that just a pointless argument to have? Like, should we just let the music be the music for what it is?
Yeah, I mean, especially the older, I think the older we get, and I think the more we realize, like, the classification really doesn't matter. Either you like it or you don't, you know what I mean? And it's like nobody does that with food. Like, nobody classifies food that much. Like, oh, I don't think that's Mexican. I think it's actually a fusion Mexican dish. Like, it's ridiculous the way we classify music. And but yeah, we definitely had like a, you know, a group of like the punk rock elite in our town, the jean jacket wearing proud, who would like definitely get all up in arms anytime something would be written about our band. That, so like, oh, punk band Motor League, they'd be like, no, that band's not a punk band. And they still do it. There's still guys that I know that are like, they'll go on Facebook, and anytime there's a review that says punk and Motor League in the same thing, they'll be like, this is not punk. It's like, who cares?
Would you classify yourself as punk? Or?
No, no, not anymore. I mean, maybe on the first record that we did was really thrashy, thrashy, bangy record, so it's a really noisy kind of rock, you know. It definitely dabbles way more in you know, thrashy, bangy punk rock than this does, but our new record is straight up rock and roll, and that's where we wanted to go, because I mean, I think we did the punky record, and then we did the follow-up to that one, and this one, you know, we kind of veered away from it a little bit.
I did notice when I was listening to soundtrack, it has like, it's hard, but it has sort of that very classic 70s sort of hard grungy rock sound.
Yeah, there's a lot of sweat in there, like it is very sweaty and bangy, and I think the live set is a lot more like you said, like that 70s like sweaty club kind of vibe then.
Sludge punk.
Yeah, yeah. It's the live is a lot more, the album's a lot more polished and stuff. But that's just because live, I think we like to play everything a little faster and a little louder and a little looser and a little more rough around the edges, and we like to, you know, bang around on stage, so I think that affects the music.
I love it when you guys were doing your soundtrack early, he started blurting off Star Wars references.
I'm like a really awkward, I find sound checks are so awkward, because you're like, test one, check one, and you gotta do that for, you know, 10 minutes. So I just started listing Star Wars. I don't know when I started doing that, but sometimes I'll do G.I. Joe action figures, like the names of G.I. Joe characters.
Yeah.
But I did Pokemons once. But mostly the Pokemon one will get you some weird looks sometimes with like sound guys. They're like, what the hell is this guy saying? Like, because, you know, if they don't know what a Squirtle is or a Charmander, they're going to be like, what is... But, you know, usually you can get away with Star Wars planets. I've definitely gotten some weird looks. So if, like, nobody knows what you're doing, they're like, what is this guy... What is he saying? But, yeah, I'm a big Star Wars nerd.
Are you excited for The Force Awakens?
Oh.
And do you have any theories as to what is going on and where Luke Skywalker is?
Okay. I mean, yes and no. Everyone's like, he's not in the trailer. He's been in the trailer.
He was in the first one. He just wasn't in the most recent one, right? And he's not on the poster.
Right, right. And it shows his hand, too,
and,
right?
But Harrison Ford's like, because you'll understand why when you see the movie.
Damn it. Okay. Did you read that theory that about Jar Jar?
Yes.
That is amazing.
Yeah, about how, like, Jar Jar, George Lucas originally meant for Jar Jar to be, like, the bad Yoda.
Well, it's a theory, so we don't know if this is actually true, but if you look at the theory, it says that every time Jar Jar Binks makes a suggestion, he waves his hand as if he's making a suggestion using the Force, and that Jar Jar Binks may actually be, like, this Sith Master, and, like, the way that he talks and everything, and him pretending to be, like, this bumbling idiot is just an act. And the theory really drives it home when they show Palpatine in the third movie, and Jar Jar is with him. And it's like, if you're Palpatine, you're like the Sith Lord, but also you're like, you know, the Supreme Chancellor, why would you have Jar Jar Binks hanging around with you?
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't think they're going to actually pull that out in the movie, but it would make episode one so much better.
Yeah, right?
If they did it, and like Jar Jar had this really deep voice, and he's like, you know, really evil, and he doesn't talk like that at all. Like, maybe he's got like a big scar or something. Yeah. Like, I'd be like, oh my God.
Well, another theory that I read is that Kylo Ren, in the new movie, is really Luke Skywalker.
I've read that, and I don't know. Like, that would imply that Luke went bad, and I want to think that Luke is infallible.
I mean, they already made... I mean, unless it's a Skywalker curse, right? But then again, Leia's a Skywalker, so technically...
Yeah, no, she definitely is. I don't know, man. I'm not buying into the Luke Kylo Ren thing. I'm not buying into it.
So, with your album... you sort of said you sort of, you know, you hunker down in the snow for a few months and just sort of hammered out the album. But how would you describe how the writing process happens? Do you guys, you know, do you find like a nice riff and then do you add lyrics to that? Be like, oh, I want to write a song about this and then jot it down and add music later.
Oh, man, it's really, with this album, it was a little bit of both. With this one, we wrote this record, the four of us together, more so than any other record that we've done. It was before, you know, someone would bring a song to the table and it would be pretty much a finished song and we would all kind of put our thing to it. But this one, we really like chunked down the four of us together. And I would usually meet with our drummer first and I'd kind of be like, here's my idea for a song. And me and him would kind of flesh out, here's where it starts, here's where it ends. And then we'd bring the other two guys in after we had the idea so that we weren't like all trying to learn the song at once. And they would be like, oh, well, let's do this, or let's do this, or let's do this. And we generally would just have a melody to start off with, and we just kind of, you know, hum garbage lyrics over it. And then once you kind of get your melody and your flow kind of nailed down, then I would sit down and start hammering out lyrics. And then, you know, even up in the studio, like, you know, the last days of recording vocals, the guys are going through all the lyrics, and they're saying, you know, what if we said this line instead of this line? And so this one was a really collaborative? I don't know if that's how you say that, but we collaborated a lot on this one. And this is the first record that we made with this, with these four guys. Half of the last record was made with this lineup, but the other half wasn't. So this is kind of like the first Motor League record that we really all made it together. And I think that we're probably the most happy with that. That, like, it's just the four of us. Nobody else plays on it. There's no other extra musicians. Like, it's just us. And I think it turned out exactly the way that we wanted it to turn out. When we kind of heard it in our heads before we made the record, like, this is what we envisioned. So we were happy with that.
Just before we started taping, we were talking about New Brunswick because I had spent some time in Woodstock.
Mm.
And you mentioned that your old band, the Ditch Pigs, were essentially responsible for You Say Party.
Inadvertently, yeah. I met the bass player before he was in that band, when he was in the Katimovic program. And I don't remember this. This would have been 15 years ago, but I guess I told him, like, oh, man, you got to start a band. Because he had mentioned it. He said, like, oh, I always wanted to start a band. And I was like, well, dude, just do it. Like, don't make excuses. Just go home and start a band. And apparently he went home and started You Say Party, or formed a band, and that band became You Say Party. So I'm not taking credit for that band, but, like, indirectly, I think we influenced him to go home and get a band together, which is fantastic because I'm a pretty big fan of that band. Well, and I saw them live and he told me that. It's just, I was beside myself.
What was that like for you, just as a musician, knowing that you influenced the live of another creative soul?
Oh, I think he would have done it either way. I think it's a cute story, and they were in Moncton, and he, you know, he got to relay that story on stage, and everyone in the crowd was like, what? Like, they were really confused when he told the story on stage. Myself included, being in the audience. But I don't, I think that band was going to happen regardless. They're just one of those few bands that are like, yeah. So I really like them. I'm a big fan.
And finally, what would you say your favorite song is, or do you have a favorite song off of Holding Pattern?
Oh, wow. It's a good question. The song Hurt Me Like You Want To, I think it's the eighth track, was actually originally called Holding Patterns. And I think that song might, for me, kind of sum up where I wanted the record to go. I like Shut Up and Listen a lot. Oh, I think, no, sorry, it's called You Won't Believe What Happens Next. We have names for all the songs that aren't the real names because, you know, a lot of the names are long. So when we write them down in the set list every night, we just write, like, the first line of the chorus or whatever, right? We'll just put, like, you know, Shut Up. And we all know what song it is. But then I forget what the actual song titles are on the album. I think every band must do that.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Monin they can't write their whole song titles down every night because that would be insane. But yeah, no, I'm going to go with that one. Track 8. Or is it track 9? It's 8? It's 8. Track 8.
Well, the band is The Motor League. The album is Holding Pattern. Don LaBandier, thanks so much for your time.
Man, thank you. This was a lot of fun. You asked good questions.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
John Stackhouse had a long career as a journalist and foreign correspondent for the Globe and Mail. In 2009, he became that national newspaper's editor-in-chief, and he held that position for 5 years, and he was also an editor of Report on Business. In addition, he is a senior fellow at the C.D. Howe Institute and University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs, and the author of the books Out of Poverty and Into Something More Comfortable and Timbit Nation, A Hitchhiker's View of Canada. He has now left the newspaper world and is now at the Royal Bank of Canada as Senior Vice President in the Office of the CEO. And he's got a new book out, Mass Disruption, 30 Years on the Front Lines of a Media Revolution. I had the chance to speak with John Stackhouse about the decline of the traditional paper media and where it stands today, and I spoke with him last week. Testing. I am joined on the phone by John Stackhouse. John, hello, welcome to the show, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, why did you decide that now was the time to write this book?
I had had a remarkable few decades in journalism and felt really like I had been given a front row seat on both the end of an era and the beginning of an era, the end of the analog era of media in the 20th century and the first couple of decades of digital journalism and digital media, and had witnessed the revolution both as a reporter and as an editor trying to help develop a new business model for media, and felt I should share that with the broader public and share it with some arguments about what's at stake for our democracy. I'm not merely exploring what's happened to media, but I want to help people see what the consequences are for us as a society if we, as consumers of media and as creators of media, don't get it right.
Now, I mean, a lot of people think that the digital age, you know, Facebook and all these online blogs ushered in the end of traditional paper media. But I get the sense that you don't feel that way. It seems to me as if the newspapers industry has been in decline since the early 90s.
Well, even before that, the decline of newspapers in terms of their prevalence, their reach in society, has been in decline since well before the internet came along. The high water mark for daily newspapers in North America was somewhere in the 1960s in terms of the sales of newspaper per 1,000 people. It was still very strong through the 80s and 90s, but was in decline. And the internet, rather than sort of being the end of newspapers, I think has created a wonderful opportunity, as has social media, for the journalism that newspapers have always been responsible for and been wonderful creators of. There is now the opportunity at hand to make that journalism more relevant and more widely consumed than ever. The challenge is making enough money from that to pay for the cost of the journalism.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is the politics of the paper. You know, you had the Globe, which was sort of the center, maybe center right. You had this the Star, which leaned a little more left, and then you had the Post come in and try to move everything to the right. Should newspapers be engaging in that sort of partisanship, or do they need to remain more neutral?
Well, it's important for newspapers, for the entity to be seen as largely nonpartisan. It may have a tilt to the right or to the left in terms of its opinion pages. Hopefully, the news content is as objective as possible. The real challenge, I think, that you're getting to is on the editorial side and the editorial position of newspapers, especially come election time. Now, newspapers are always great and important and valued critics of government, whether at the municipal, provincial, or federal level, and should remain so. But come election time, newspapers generally have felt an obligation to take a position and present that position to readers as to who they should support. I don't believe newspapers are or should be instructing people how to vote. First of all, they can't, and they wouldn't be able to influence readers to that degree. But there is a value in a newspaper, and especially the editorial page, taking a well-reasoned position, arguing for that position, so that readers can come to grips with their own position. They may agree, or they may better formulate their own thinking to offer.
Yeah. But that brings up the greater question of, is there such thing as true objective journalism?
That's one of the eternal questions of media. And on one level, of course there isn't, because there may be no such thing as objectivity, but certainly in news reporting, even those reporters who consider themselves independent, and sometimes it's better just to talk about independent journalism than objective journalism, because of course we all come from a place, and that makes us subjects of that place. For those of us covering foreign wars, for instance, as objective as we try to be, we come from the West, and we have a certain set of values which define or shape the way that we see things. And people in other countries would often say to me, as a foreign correspondent, when I was working overseas, that I could not see their country or their situation objectively because I came from somewhere else and would have the perspective of my home country. And I think there's a good degree of truth to that. And that applies as well to what journalists are doing here or on home soil. So on one level, as I say, I prefer to refer to independent journalism. Journalism that is not beholden to particular interests, rather than in getting into a more philosophical debate about objectivity. But all that being said, I think Canadians would be wise to appreciate, ensure that we protect the reasonable objectivity that our news reporting has and certainly has had for most of our history, unlike some of the trends you're seeing emerge in the United States, where news reporting, especially when it comes to politics, is not what most consumers in this country would consider to be objective.
You know, on that note, one of the topics you talk about in the book is CNN, and then about how when that came in, it ushered in a new era of news and the 24-hour news cycle. But now sort of CNN is being derided as everything that's wrong with mainstream media. What is your take on that?
Well, CNN was revolutionary in the 1980s in that it really created 24/7 news, always on, always there. And that was remarkable, as you know, as we live through moments of history like the fall of the Berlin Wall and the first Iraq War, watching those as live TV events was extraordinary and unlike anything news consumers had seen before. The challenge for CNN was that it's hard to match the sort of the compelling force of such events, and so in between those historically epic events, the 24/7 channel has to provide something, and provide something that keeps a good number of viewers coming back. And so it really pushed the boundaries on what we would call breaking news and what they called breaking news. And almost everything became breaking news and developed a certain urgency well out of proportion with its ultimate consequence to society. And as a result, I think we lost perspective on what truly mattered, because the cable news channels, and there were many more that came after CNN, had to, by the curse of their own 24/7 cycle, convince viewers that everything mattered, everything was urgent, whether it was something minor at 2 in the morning or something major during the daytime. It was all urgent all the time. So that has been a challenge for media to come to grips with and find ways to ensure that we're giving perspective to viewers, to readers, on what matters and why it matters.
On that note, like it seems now that there's more of a rush to be first to report the story rather than to be right about what it is you're reporting on. Why has that become such a problem?
Well, it's certainly one of the curses of competition is that people sometimes lower their standards, and in a media, the race to be first, as you say, has often or certainly occasionally trumped the need to be accurate. But those news organizations that have erred on that side, I think, have lived to regret it. And it's important for news organizations and news consumers to appreciate the essential need to be accurate before being first. And on many news stories, we can all wait a minute or two for independent media to double source facts and ensure what we are hearing and what many of us are sharing instantly through social media is indeed accurate.
I wanted to touch on that because social media is very interesting to me. It seems that, you know, with things like Facebook or Twitter or Huffington Post, people tend to consume news that maybe fits their ideology. So conservatives will watch Fox News, maybe liberals will watch MSNBC. Do you foresee that becoming a major problem in the future, the fact that we're becoming so polarized in that way?
Yes, this is a huge challenge to us as a democracy and to all of us as citizens, that we are seeing the polarization not just of the electorate, more so in the United States than in Canada, but we're not immune to it, but we've seen a polarization of news consumption and people looking to news outlets for validation of their political thinking. Ironically, this was how media was in the 1800s. Newspapers were, for the most part, sort of political sheets and polemics, often owned by politicians. George Brown, the first publisher owner of the Globe, before it became the Globe and Mail, was also head of the Liberal Party. And his editorials, he'd write editorials for the Morning Globe and then often read a version of them as a speech in Parliament in the afternoon. So it's not a new phenomenon, but what we saw is a rise of independent media in the 20th century, owned by commercial interests, has shifted in a way back to that politically partisan-driven media, and that should be a concern.
One of the things that you touch upon in the book is you talk about how the conglomerates came in. You had Global and CTV, which are privately held independent companies, and then you have something like CBC, which is of course funded by the taxpayers and owned by the government. And then you're also seeing things like Democracy Now, which is completely funded by donations. Why is it important to have all these different types of voices within the media?
Well, competition is generally good, and more ideas, more information is generally better than less. It keeps all of us not only more informed but more honest. It's interesting to see the rise of new forms of media. You cited Democracy Now, and there's a fascinating trend among both NGOs and think tanks and universities, as well as corporations and industry groups, to through various websites that either go by their name or are sponsored by them, to craft what might be perceived as journalism, in independent reporting and commentary on the events around us. In a way, that's good, but of course there is the risk, and we should all be mindful of it, that that organizations may be masquerading as news outlets to try to persuade the public to pay attention to a particular issue or particular point of view.
Speaking of persuasion, I feel like the younger generation, millennials, one way that they seem to be getting their stories, getting their information, is through programs like the Daily Show with Jon Stewart or John Oliver's new program. Comedians have seemed to have found a way to make the news exciting, for lack of a better term. Is that a good thing, or should traditional media be worried about that?
Yeah, I find that a curious trend, and not offended by it. Like I love what they do. If I have a concern, it's only when people use someone like Jon Stewart as their only source for news. But I have a concern with anyone, including myself, who would rely on only one source for all of my news. What I find fascinating about sort of the comedy show phenomenon is how instantly popular that has become with what you call a new generation, and how traditional media missed the opportunity. There's no reason that the New York Times or Guardian or CBC or the Globe and Mail could not have created a version of Jon Stewart in a decade ago or in the 1990s and used humor to pull people into news and then maybe extend that conversation into other more traditional forms of news. So there may be a lesson there or an insight for traditional media companies to gain from what Jon Stewart has created.
And finally, you're out of the newspaper world now. You're working for RBC. What do you make of the sort of the state of the media now that you're on the outside of it and in the financial world?
Well, clearly the media industry is troubled. If you look at the financial results of any media company, look at the layoffs continuing to come out of media companies, it's deeply challenged, and that's a worry for me as a citizen, as a news consumer. But what gives me hope is that there continues to be, despite the economic pressures, a great supply of excellent journalism, as good or more than I can remember, just sometimes harder to find in an ever-rising sea of information and ideas, and also a great demand. Whenever we have kind of serious events around us, be it the recent federal election or a terrorist attack or something like the Boston bombing, people tend to go to credible news sources to find out what happened, to talk about with other readers, other news consumers, about what's going on. So that sort of demand for quality journalism and the ongoing supply of quality journalism gives me hope. The remaining challenge continues to be the economic model, obviously not to be belittled. It's an epic challenge, but if there's that much demand for something and a good supply of it, surely there's a good economic model out there to be developed.
Well, the book is Mass Disruption. It's a very, very good read. Jon Stackhouse, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Cheers. That was Jon Stackhouse. Once again, his Mass Disruption, 30 years on the front lines of a media revolution. Right now, you're going to hear a song by The Dying Arts off their album, You Had It Coming. This is Constantines.